it leads to acquire power by means of a competitive struggle for the people's vote. Quoting now directly from Schumpeter, democracy means only that the people have the opportunity of accepting or refusing the men who are to rule them. And it is this conception that guides U.S. foreign policy under the banner of democracy promotion. Later, organic intellectuals further refined this polyarchic conception in the mainstream of what came to be democratization theory of the 1980s and 1990s as an institutional definition in which democracy is simply limited to procedurally correct elections within a constitutional order. And in this way, you'll note, entirely removed from the discourse, from the whole agenda, is the matter of who controls society's material and cultural resources? Who decides how those resources will be distributed and put to use? How is wealth and power distributed locally and globally? Who exercises real power and for what purposes? And this brings me to the third of the 5 points, this separation of the political from the socioeconomic in U.S. polyarchy promotion. And here there is a theoretical contradiction that reflects the real social contradiction between neoliberal capitalism on the one hand and democracy on the other. And central to democratization theory and to the U.S. policy of promoting polyarchy is an antinomy. First, its defenders separate the political system from the social order, and then they turn around and connect the two by claiming an affinity between democracy and free market capitalism. In their NED-funded Democracy in Developing Countries series, Diamond, Lintz, and Lipset are quite clear, and I quote them, "Democracy signifies a political system separate and apart from the economic and social system. Indeed, a distinctive aspect of our approach is to insist that the issue of so-called economic and social democracy be separated from the question of governmental structure." Yet, on the other hand, these self-same organic intellectuals and U.S. policymakers blatantly contradict themselves. They insist that polyarchy must go hand in hand with neoliberal global capitalism. If there is no free market capitalism, there's no democracy. That in order to be democratic, one must be capitalist, and not any capitalist, but neoliberal capitalism, global capitalism. And so normal society is capitalist society, and any other vision is anti-democratic heresy. Numerous State Department and other U.S. government pronouncements declare explicitly that promoting democracy and promoting free market capitalism or neoliberalism are complementary, a singular process in U.S. foreign policy. Now, with the cliche, market democracy or free market democracy. And indeed, central to U.S. polyarchy promotion is supporting those business groups, political parties, and civic organizations in intervened countries that favor neoliberal reform and capitalist globalization and marginalizing those groups who oppose it. And of course, if we were to acknowledge the link between the socioeconomic system and the political system, the whole construct of polyarchy would come down like a house of cards. Under capitalist globalization of the past 30 years, the gap between the world's richest and the world's poorest is growing exponentially. The United Nations Development Program, it's reported to us in 2001 that the richest 20% of humanity received 85% of the world's wealth in that year, while the remaining 20% of the humanity had access to only 15% of that wealth, and the poorest 20% had access to only 1%. That report further points out that the assets of the 200 wealthiest people in the world are greater than the total income of 40% of the world's population. And there has been, in the last 15 years or 20 years, a spate of other social scientific studies confirming this dramatic polarization of wealth worldwide under capitalist globalization. The pattern here seems to be that below the super rich and the rich are the rise of middle classes and professional segments integrated into the global cornucopia, alongside the downward mobility and impoverishment for majorities who face deepening crises of social reproduction, of survival. At the turn of the century, according to the United Nations data I've been citing, 1.2 billion people lived in total indigence, and another 3.3 billion people on the planet lived at poverty levels. So that is close to 4/5 of humanity, at a time when the world has never known such material abundance, such wealth-generating capacity. So the problem is not that there is not enough to go around. There is. The question is, who controls these collective resources? Who decides how they are put to use? Global inequalities and immiseration have systemic causes, and I can't here analyze the nature of global capitalism and its causal relation to global social polarization. But it is clear, for our purposes here, that such unprecedented concentrations of wealth and power in global society is the antithesis of democracy, that capitalist globalization, therefore, is profoundly anti-democratic. We have a vast amount of social science research showing that the separation of the political and the socioeconomic is an illusion, that economic power translates into political influence. In the US, we have perfected the art of the best elections money can buy, of $1, one vote, of campaigns that are exercised not in political debate, but in mass marketing, and who has the resources to do mass marketing. The concentration of economic resources leads to the concentration of political power. Political rights and socioeconomic rights are not separate items. They are two sides of the very same coin. And it is deceptive to believe that we can talk about real democracy in the political sphere alongside what amounts to a socioeconomic dictatorship. In a world of gated communities, of expanding police forces and prison systems, of armies, of private security forces and ultra-sophisticated surveillance systems, in short, in a Blade Runner global society, in a global social apartheid, it becomes a crude ideological maneuver to claim that there is democracy simply because there are elections and a constitution. We are living in a global apartheid system because, on the one hand, a tiny minority of humanity exercises ever greater control over the material resources of the planet. And because, on the other hand, this control allows a tiny minority of elites to exercise real political power to the exclusion of the vast majority of humanity. Power in the international state system is exercised by a handful of the most powerful states, the group of rich eight countries. But beyond the international dictatorship of the G8 countries, there are other groups that participate in the power structures of global capitalism and who enjoy and defend the privileges that this system brings. Each country has seen the rise of new transnationally oriented elites and economic elites who have utilized control over local states to integrate their countries into the global economy. And these local elites strata form an integral part of the chain of power in the global system. They control key levers that link the local and the national to the global. And it is precisely these new elite groups and their followers, organized in business associations, political parties, civic organizations, the mass media, and so on, that are supported by U.S. political intervention programs conducted under the rubric of promoting democracy. And that leads me to the fourth of my five points. How does polyarchy promotion actually function? What does the U.S. actually do on the ground in intervened country when it launches political intervention programs under the name of promoting democracy? Well, after some 20-odd years of investigating and exposing polyarchy promotion, and I've been at this since the mid-1980s, we know exactly what's going on. It's all been thoroughly documented. And I would say there are three countries now, that groups of countries that become targets of U.S. political intervention. The first is the U.S. enemies list, and these countries are targeted for destabilization. The new catchword is regime change. This would include Venezuela currently in Latin America, Nicaragua, Haiti under Aristide, Cuba, Serbia under Milosevic, if we would go further now, Iran, and so forth. And the criteria here for destabilization and regime change through so-called democracy promotion is not democracy and whether it exists or not, but strategic concerns. And these programs are called bringing about a democratic transition. Then we have a second category of countries where popular classes and poor majorities are threatening elite social orders. This would be Bolivia before the recent elections, Ecuador right now, Peru, Colombia, Venezuela before Chavez, South Africa in the late apartheid era, El Salvador recently and currently, and so forth. And these programs are called supporting weak democracies. Then we have a third category of countries where neoliberal elites are in power, but they are weak and they need strengthening, and where dominant elites need to be not destabilized, but neoliberalized, reorganized, maybe nudged out of office in favor of some other groups. And these programs are called strengthening existing democracies. And in all of these three categories, U.S. polyarchy promotion programs seek two things in an underlying level. First, to support those groups and elites aligned with U.S. foreign policy and the transnational project of neoliberalism and capitalist globalization. And secondly, and equally or more importantly, to suppress, marginalize, malign, and compete with those that are struggling for something different, generally a more thoroughgoing democratization and for fundamental change in the socioeconomic system. Now, before polyarchy promotion programs are launched, there are several tiers of policy design, funding, operational activity, and influence. The first involves the highest levels of the U.S. state apparatus, the White House, the State Department, the Pentagon, the CIA, and certain other state branches. And it is at this level, the highest tier, that the overall need to undertake political intervention in particular countries and regions is identified as one component of overall policy towards these